Hi, everyone. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the popular books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that we see lying underneath all of it.
You betcha. You betcha. And this week, we're looking at the one reality of In Bruges.
I'm sorry I had to laugh.
This is episode number 29, by the way.
Yeah,
and
you didn't want to say the one effing reality.
One effing reality, right? And this is written and directed by Martin McDonagh. Is that how I pronounce his name? McDonagh.
I don't know, but after this, I would go see any play he wrote.
Yeah,
because he's a playwright primarily.
Right. I wonder what else he's done here. Looks like he has a movie coming out called Seven Psychopaths.
Oh, well, maybe I wouldn't see that. I don't know. Although, I've seen this three times, so maybe I have to.
Well, this movie is about several psychopaths as well.
Yes. Well, this is his first and only movie up to this point.
So. Yeah. And if you haven't seen it before, it is rated R. If you took the swearing out, it'd probably be about a half an hour long.
And the extreme violence. Well, I guess most of the extreme violence is at the end, but there's all kinds of other weirdness too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So, good Catholic movie. What? So, tell us a little about it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you bet. What it's about are these two hitmen, Ken and Ray, who have recently performed a hit somewhere in England, and their boss sent them to Bruges for they're not sure what reason. But they go to Bruges. They end up needing to stay in the same room. It looks like it's going to be a long wait. So they're there in Bruges just waiting for their boss to call and tell them what to do next. Ray is someone who is ridden with guilt. He's the younger of the two. Ken is kind of an older veteran hitman who's, I don't know, more or less happy to be in Bruges. And
sightseeing,
having a great time. And Ray, pretty much immediately, in fact, even before they pull in, is pretty unhappy about having to go to Bruges. This is he hates it. You know, so as the movie progresses and they're waiting for their boss to call, they go sightseeing and that type of thing, which Ken is really enjoying and Ray is not. But Ray, again, you know, the key thing to know about Ray is that he's just ridden with guilt.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure what else to say about the movie. It's not, I certainly haven't given it justice in any way, because the charm of it, if you can call it a charm, I guess I'm going to call it a charm, even though it is ridden with swearing, like I said, and there's also some very violent parts in it. It's got this charm that's just unbelievable. And the story is very well constructed. The script is excellent. The actors are superb. This is a 5-star movie.
And I would say if you haven't seen it, despite the fact that, you know, they're talking about effing this and effing that, every other word, literally sometimes, and the violence is... that it is also a real old school morality tale, and almost the way that I've heard described, since I haven't read it, the Chaucer story, the famous pilgrimage story of all
Canterbury Tales.
Thank you. And in terms of nothing's held back, and you know these people have done good things and bad things, and through watching them interact, you see real definite moral messages coming out of redemption and second chances and salvation. And
yeah,
even when they don't even want it. And I think the part of the charm is Bruges itself. And part of the charm, because, you know, it is, everybody keeps saying, a fairy tale town, which is what it's known for. But part of the charm is that Brendan Gleeson, who plays Ken, the older, experienced gunman, and Colin Farrell, who plays Ray, the young, very, very shallow guy, are so likable.
Yeah.
They're, you grow to very quickly like and even love these characters and care about them a lot. And it's I got to give the tribute to the acting for that.
Yeah, and I couldn't help. This is the second time I've seen it. Okay. And I couldn't help comparing it with Fargo. Have you seen Fargo?
I have, although I really am one of those few people who I'm not a real fan of the Coen brothers, and this I really didn't care about Fargo. But
yeah, so in comparison, you know, just with the title, first of all, you know, their names of towns, and the second thing is there's kind of an ultra violence behind the actions of the characters. And then the characters are extremely quirky. The dialogue is extremely witty, and there are characters that in Fargo that are very difficult not to like, even though they've done some things that are, you know, horrendous.
Yeah.
So to me, you know, that's the comparison. They seem to be if they were a genre, I would say they were the same genre.
Yeah, that kind of black comedy, I guess.
Yeah, black comedy, kind of violence, almost like a Quentin Tarantino mold, you know, kind of from that same school. That's what I'd say.
And I don't really remember Fargo. Like I say, I really didn't like it. But you can tell me if this comparison is true or not, because to me, I don't remember Fargo, the characters being likable, because partly you find out the depths of their character. And with, for instance, Ray, who's the shallow one who, you know, like he'd rather be anywhere than in Bruges. A bar is his idea of a good time, you know, with a lot of music and everything. But he, because of the guilt that he feels and showing that those depths are there and that he can't forget his guilt, that's part of what makes him a likable character. He's not... You know, even Ralph Fiennes' character, Harry, has unexpected depths, like when you see him with his children and everything. And so because you get to see more levels and layers to them, there's more there to connect with.
Yeah, and I guess I can't disagree that the character that leaps out to me about Fargo is actually not one of the, you know, quote-unquote bad guys. It's the sheriff. Frances McDormand.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she was tremendous in that movie. And, you know, I felt there was real depth to her character. I don't recall the villains being more in Fargo than kind of a comedic back and forth all the time. You know, I remember somebody wanted pancakes. Pancakes, you know. But, I can say it's been a long time since I've seen it. If I had, you know, a depth to the character. But... I would say if I had to choose between the two as to which one I thought was better, I would pick this one. But I think that the comparison, that's what I thought of about halfway through this one. I was like, wow, this is, you know, you can compare this to Fargo.
Okay. I believe you.
So. All right. Yeah. And Fargo itself was not really a character in Fargo, you know, like it is here. I mean, Bruges, it's. Bruges is part of this movie, like you said. It's like a character in this film.
It definitely is that, and then I guess we get into the more in depth conversation and the spoilers. But that, and for me especially, this is my third time seeing it. The paintings of Hieronymus Bosch.
Yeah.
to me, that's as much a character or more than the town of Bruges.
Yes, yeah. So. Yeah, it was. That was a heck of a scene. So, sorry. Yeah, let's go ahead and get right into it.
No, I was going to say even more. Yeah, go ahead.
Let's just go ahead and get right into it. So spoilers after this. If you want to go watch the movie, go watch it. And then turn this back on.
Yep.
All right. So
I will tell you that a friend of mine,
Yeah.
I was having lunch with a bunch of ladies who just Catholic women who I know who are friends of mine, and I was talking about this movie, and this friend of mine says, "Oh, well, you can imagine how I felt then, because I've been to Bruges and I saw the name of the movie and went, oh, I've been there, and I knew nothing about it." I put it in and started watching it. I was like, what is this? Now, to her credit, I say she watched the whole thing, liked it, said, "Oh wow, what a great movie for Lent," you know, all that kind of thing. But
oh wow, yeah,
it was hilarious. Here, I can't even imagine not having any idea at all, and then like the second sentence, "Well, we're in effing Bruges, aren't we?"
Yeah, poor Ray, poor Ray.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, the reason why Ray is so riddled with guilt is not because he's a hitman. It's because in the hit that they just performed in England, he accidentally killed a little boy while doing his job. Mm-hmm. And that just permeates his character throughout the whole thing. And one of the things that struck me this time watching it is, you know, it's really interesting that these guys have a very rigid set of rules that they follow. Rigid set of moral rules.
Right.
Even though they don't match, like, my moral rules. It was really interesting how set they were in those rules. And it affected Harry especially, you know, late in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Well, they're and they're a set of they always tell the truth.
Yeah.
Especially Ray and Harry are like bookends, basically, to me. Harry was like an older version of it. If Ray just kept going, he'd be just like Harry.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're extremely literal. They're both very childlike. They both can't really control themselves very well in moments of stress, you know. Like when we first see Harry and he's beating the phone into a pulp.
Right.
Because it's mad. But yeah, you're right. They both they all have this moral code, and they absolutely do not betray it. And one thing I thought was interesting is I watched, again, the actors talking about being in the movie, and Brendan Gleeson, who played Ken, said, I don't think this was communicated in the script as much, but he took Ken for, this was a pivotal moment for him when he suddenly said, I'm going to go beyond my usual hitman thing, because he bonded with Ray and said, wait a minute, I'm going to develop a little more. I'm going to further, I guess it's the next moral step for him, is that he chooses something besides supporting Harry.
Yeah. And there's that moment in the movie where, you know, I'm assuming people have seen it at this point, but when Ken is going to kill Ray, because that was his instructions from Harry.
Yeah.
And he goes into that park and Ray's about to kill himself. And that was completely unacceptable. That was, you know, no way, you can't do that. You know, I can kill you, but you can't kill yourself. And then he ended up at that moment, killing him was no longer an option, because getting him over wanting to kill himself was more important than doing the job. And that was fascinating.
There was a different moral culpability to him, I think. That's also reflected at the end when Harry's like, oh my gosh, I shot a child and I had said I would kill myself if I ever did that.
Yeah.
That's what I got to do. And on the ground with like five or six bullets that have gone through him, Ray's going, no, you don't understand.
Yeah.
He's like, don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And which I thought was, you know, it's that instinctive, no, wait, you're not basing this on correct information, you know?
And
so in both those cases, it's not acceptable to do that.
Yeah.
The only time it's acceptable is when Ken throws himself from the bell tower as a noble gesture to get Ray's attention.
Yeah.
To tell him Harry's after him.
Yeah, and isn't it interesting as well that Harry, the whole reason that they're in Bruges in the first place is because he wanted Ray to feel good about himself, or to have a last good experience and the last good experience. And then, you know, before he died. And then Ken can't kill him if he wants to kill himself. It's almost as if, you know, Harry and Ken are agreeing that Ray needs to be happy before he's killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he needs to be released of his guilt before they kill him.
Yeah, it's funny. Well, and the whole thing, they at one point are sightseeing and they look through a museum. And they come across this big painting by Hieronymus Bosch, who no one's ever heard of, and I hadn't before this movie. Although we have this set of very small books called The Essential, you know, so-and-so, The Essential Monet, The Essential Van Gogh, The Essential Hieronymus Bosch. And they're just very short overviews of these artists and why they're important and some, looking at some of their work. And so we were reading through that, and I have to say, if you've never seen a Hieronymus Bosch painting, go look at some of them are normal looking, but some of them are things that you would think somebody like Salvador Dali did. Yeah. Really surreal looking people with animal heads and just horrible things happening to people. And they've confused art critics for a really long time who didn't understand what was going on. And it seems like they've concluded that, oh, these are the kinds of stories people would tell each other at the time about what happens in hell or purgatory or, you know, when we can't see, this is the invisible world of witches and things. So they just feel like he was painting those things, but no one else was doing that, really.
Mm-hmm.
He's the only one. And there are these giant paintings. And so I look at those paintings and I think of them as bringing out of the invisible into the real world the effect of your sins. And here's what's going to happen to you if you don't follow the right way, kind of thing. He's making these grotesque things visible. Because we kind of gloss over.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I did this. But, you know, it doesn't really hurt anyone. Well, we don't know that.
Yeah. And one of the paintings that I recall in the movie was someone was sort of being skinned alive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Having their skin taken off. And it's kind of a grimace on his face, like, you know, ow.
Well, and they were saying, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
they
I'm just saying it was fascinating that, you know, Ray's reaction to it all.
He loved that painting.
Yeah.
And he related to it. And he was like, oh, the others are rubbish, but this is brilliant. You know? It's like heaven and hell. And what's the other place? Purgatory.
Yeah.
Oh, purgatory.
Yeah. That's when you're, you know, I'm not going to use his words, but that's when you're crap, but not total crap.
Right.
Like Tottenham. Yeah. Fascinating stuff.
But if you look at it, that whole experience, I think the entire movie is basically that painting.
Hmm.
Because they're in a gorgeous background. It's beautiful. I mean, of the painting, it's, you know, a very nice countryside type setting. If you look at the painting, but all these other things are happening. And Bruges is like a fairy tale town. They keep saying it over and over. Who wouldn't want to go to an effing fairy tale town? Come on. Mm-hmm. And at one point, when Harry is talking to Ken on the phone, Ray's not there, about why he sent them there. So that because he went there once when he was young, it was like being in a fairy tale. He absolutely loved it. And he wanted to do something nice for Ray before he had him killed. And he says he gets mad because he hasn't confided this deeper reason to Ken yet. And Ken says, well, I like it, but it's not really Ray's kind of thing. And he's like, what? And he gets really furious. And so Ken has to make up, oh, wait, you know what happened? That was just at the train station. Mm-hmm. You know what happened? There was kind of a freezing fog. And he said, you know I'm awake, but I feel like I'm in a dream. And he said that two or three times, and I suddenly was like, that's what this whole movie's like.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm awake, but it's like being in a dream. And by the very end of the movie, because they're on this movie set, they're staggering through this movie set as there's a gun chase, as Harry says, don't be daft. This is the shootout. they're staggering through it, and there's this freezing fog, and there's all these people who are dressed up just like the characters in The Last Judgment. I mean, you couldn't have it any clearer that it's like I'm awake, but it's like I'm in a dream.
Yeah.
And it's the last judgment for all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, Ken, sure is.
Ken's
yeah.
dead. Harry's got to make a decision. And Ray, he's hovering in between. Will he die or will he not? We don't know.
Yeah.
And he says, for him, Bruges is hell. And I hope I don't die. I hope I don't die. And I was like, well, that's the whole point of that painting. And that's the whole point of him being there in that movie, is to bring him to a point of contrition, not that he kills himself, but that he sees how awful it could be, even though most of us wouldn't think Bruges is that way.
Mm-hmm.
I realize I'm kind of diving into a little deeper water at this point.
No,
but
that's great. Yeah, it was interesting to me, you know, throughout the whole movie, he's contemplating suicide the entire time and practically does it one time. And then at this point, like you said, he realizes something has changed inside him, and he wants to live really bad, even though he's, you know, mortally wounded. You know, we don't know what happens after the credits, but the fact that he has changed his mind and now he wants to live, that's a big change, and that became the end of the movie.
And the thing I thought was interesting is it wasn't because of anything, except he says, maybe hell was Bruges, and I really hoped I wouldn't die. I really hoped I wouldn't die. And I thought, that's the whole reason that, you know, all those pictures of hell, it's not to show you how weird people think of hell. It's to make you realize this could be you. You don't want to be here. This is bad, you know, and that's what it did for him. You know,
yeah.
And Ken had told him the way to redeem himself or to make amends, I guess, is, you know, help some other little boy. You know, do something good, save some other boy. You know, make amends with your life, basically.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, Ken's example of, you know, what Ken did for him made him finally realize that he's got to do that for someone else.
Yeah, and although extremely imperfect, because you hear about the things that Ken has done, you realize you see him as a nice guy, but he ain't no nice guy, really.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He is, though, the Christ figure in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, they couldn't make it much clearer. I mean, because when he's at the top of the bell tower with Harry.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And Harry shoots him in the leg, and he's like, oh, and he says, well, you think I'm not going to shoot you just because you're standing around like Robert effing Powell. Who? Robert effing Powell and effing Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Okay. And then later on when he, you know, they've been halfway down the stairs, they have the big fight because Ray's back in town and Harry's going to go kill him. And he's going back up the stairs and they're showing these huge pools of blood up the stairs behind him. And I was like, wow, this is just like when he goes up the tower at the beginning to sightsee, and he's going to go see the blood of Christ in the vial.
Yeah.
And I was like, so there's all these things kind of leading you to, he's going to make this redemptive sacrificial act to try to save him, because as he said, he's got a chance. He could be saved. You and I can't.
Mm-hmm.
When he's talking to Harry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's doing everything in his power, including giving himself up in the worst possible way to try to give Ray a chance to change, because that's all important. He could still change. And in fact, we see Ken change. I mean, we see after the change, actually.
But yeah. 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 I think, you know, yeah, Ken changes at the moment where he decides not to shoot or not to go through with his job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then he's a kind of a different guy from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
One other reference that they made that I looked up was, you remember when Ray said, oh, they're filming midgets, you know, and he runs over there and he meets this girl, and the girl tells him, yeah, this is kind of a pastiche of Don't Look Back, which, so I looked that up, and I don't think that I've seen it, but Don't Look Back is by a director named Nicholas Roeg, R-O-E-G, from the descriptions I've read, it's kind of a famous movie. It stars Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland.
Oh.
And it says, John and Laura Baxter are living in Venice when they meet a pair of elderly sisters, one of whom claims to be psychic. She insists that she sees the spirit of the Baxter's daughter, who recently drowned. Laura is intrigued, but John resists the idea. He, however, seems to have his own psychic flashes, seeing their daughter walk the streets in her red cloak, as well as Laura and the sisters on a funeral gondola. So the image, though, of the girl running around town in a red cloak and being ghostly is something that I've seen a lot in film. And it looks to me, just from what I've read, that this is where it started. Oh, everything else is sort of copying that.
Oh, okay.
So fascinating, yeah. Because the kid, you know, even though we see him so briefly, the one that Ray killed is
right.
kind of in that movie the whole time.
Yeah, and wasn't that a poignant moment when he takes the note and what he was confessing?
Oh, yeah.
He was there for confession. He's, you know, I'm moody, I was sad, I was bad at maths or something, you know. Right. And it's like, just, it highlights the innocence and purity of that little boy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of funny because in his own way, Ray is so childlike and, you know, and literal like that.
Yes.
You know, and it's also, there's not one good person in this movie except for we never see the innkeeper, but the innkeeper's wife, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Every other person we meet is somehow has got some layer of culpability and awfulness. You know, the girl he meets lures in tourists, and then the boyfriend comes in and pretends to be jealous, and they take their money, or she sells drugs, or...
And that was another example of this moral code that's so rigid. When Ray is, you know, held at gunpoint by this boyfriend, and he wrestles the gun away, he finds out that it's got blanks in it.
Yeah.
And then shoots the guy in the face, which, you know, blinds him in one eye.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he's like, you know... He called him a poof, I think. I think, you know, when did skinheads become such poofs? And then later on, Harry meets this guy, and this guy says, yeah, I want Ray dead too, because he did this to me, and, you know, I was trying to rob him, and he did this to me, and I can't believe it. I'll never see through this eye again. And Harry says, well, it sounds like it was your fault.
Yeah, like, you
because you're a big poof.
Yeah.
You know, but it's funny that they've got these rules ingrained in them. You know, here he is, you know, trying to kill Ray, and he's like, yeah, but, you know, Ray, you know, he knows the rules, and he's following them. That stood out to me as another example of this rigid thing that they've got going. It's almost as if, you know, we kill people for a living, but to make us feel okay about that, we've got these other rules that we enforce, you know, unflinchingly.
That's just business.
Yeah, that's business. But, you know, I'm going to apologize to my wife for calling her an inanimate object. You know, when he got mad about the phone, you know, she says,
I'm sorry.
He says, you're an inanimate object. And that's an inanimate object. And he says, no, you're an inanimate object. And then he apologizes to her later. He's going to kill somebody. And he says, you know, sorry about calling you an inanimate object. I was upset.
Yeah, and they're using the worst possible language the entire time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just fascinating. Yeah, I'm going to do this terrible thing. But, you know, it's important to me to apologize to you. And I don't think it was because he thought he was going to die. It sure didn't seem to me that he had any inkling.
Oh, no.
I'm not going to, you know. So he wasn't, like, saying goodbye to her in any way. This is just one of his rules.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and it was because she was worried, because she said, you'll take the fellas with you. And he's like, no, I got to take care of this myself.
Yeah.
So she's upset, and he goes, hey, I'm sorry I called you an inanimate object. You know, I love you, basically.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I know.
It's interesting that he didn't say that. That's another interesting thing. Because Ken told him that he loved him. Told Harry.
Right.
He said, I love you. Yeah. And Harry's face kind of went all grimacy, you know. That's interesting that's where we hear that. I don't know that we heard I love you in any in any other time in the movie. I wasn't looking for it, but I don't think we did.
I don't think so.
And that's interesting, and it feeds into the whole Christ figure thing that you were talking about.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. And I did what you didn't want me to do. I get that. I'll take anything you want to give me because I owe you. You've always had my back. I love you like a brother. But I had to do this. Here's why I had to do this. And he knows Harry can't accept that. That's not part of Harry's moral code. It's something he himself had just come to understand.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, I'll take it. I earned it. So he's basically, he's going to take on Ray's punishment.
Yeah.
He'll let himself be killed instead of Ray, because he let Ray, at that point, everybody thinks Ray's on a train out of town. So, yeah. You couldn't get much clearer. And he's like, well, now I can't do it. And it's funny how this shifts, because I was thinking of Ken and Ray. You know, Ken's going to shoot Ray. Then he sees Ray who's going to shoot himself. He's like, oh, you can't do that. That's not right. And then Ray turns around and he's, you were going to shoot me. Like, well, you were going to kill yourself. Yeah, but that's different. You were going to shoot me. It was a betrayal.
Yeah,
you know?
It really was.
You know, yeah. And so
I wasn't going to follow through with it. Yes, you
fluid.
Were.
Fluid. Yeah. I wasn't going to follow through with it. I think you were, you know. Yeah. And he was.
Yeah.
Because he's, I'm sorry. And he's, you know, marching across there.
Mm-hmm.
And did you notice the music?
I did notice the music at a couple of points in the movie. It really stood out to me. The music did.
Yeah.
I didn't look into it at all, but. There was one, it sounded like it was from an opera or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall the other time, but I know that there are two specific times that it leapt out to me.
Well, and I didn't look into it either, but I remember it started up, and there's this, Bruges has its own theme, really. So when you're looking at Bruges, there's this very simple, beautiful little theme that's going. And then what I kind of noticed, and I don't know anything about music, so anybody who does could laugh at this point, but it seemed to me that there was another theme for when things were going wrong. Not when they're being chased, there was kind of a militant theme, but there was another theme for, like, you know, they wandered onto the set of the movie where everybody's dressed like Hieronymus Bosch characters and everything. And Ray's been shot and he's staggering. And all of a sudden, it's an extremely simple little theme. And it's almost like they took that really nice little theme and just made it atonal and weird enough.
Hmm.
And I said something to Tom about that. And he goes, well, the music and the movie are both the same. They're both like that Bosch painting. He goes, they're timeless and beautiful. And you can't quit looking at them because they're so perfect at what they are. And he goes, but it's so repulsive that you have a hard time even looking at it at the same time.
Hmm.
And I was like,
that's interesting.
I guess that's true. That's what makes this movie like one of those paintings. You know, the details are fascinating, but at the same time, there's repulsive stuff happening.
Yeah, for sure.
You know?
And, you know, if I kind of go back to the comparison with the Coen brothers or with Quentin Tarantino, What is it about these movies? This one is special and different from those. But, you know, with a Quentin Tarantino movie, for example, what is it about this incredible violence and stuff that is appealing? I don't know if you like a Quentin Tarantino movies at all.
I would like to watch one sometime, but I'm terrified of the violence.
Okay.
I've seen one which is, oh gosh, what's the one with Jackie Brown?
Oh, okay.
And that one I saw just a couple of years ago maybe, and I found it disappointing. Because
I've seen that one, and I wouldn't say that
that's probably not
best
one of his finer
way.
Pieces. You can see his fascination with language, and I know about that. I mean, they just talk things to death, and then I could see the plot twist coming like a mile away for some reason in that one. It was very obvious. So I've never watched the others just because they're so violent. Like
yeah,
this
and that's what they are. Yeah, and this one is violent. It's got that violence in it too, but I don't know. Here, I mean, I don't know if I'd call it gratuitous in this one, but it's shocking. There's some moments in there that are just shocking.
Well,
and you know, maybe that's what the appeal is. You know, you know, when someone jumps out a window, for example, you can show the aftermath, right? But
right.
How often do you see the moment of impact? And well, it was, you know, just like, holy cow, you know?
Yeah. Well, I have to say, the other thing is the actress who plays the very good character, Marie, is mm-hmm. pregnant, and it's yeah. Christmas time. So you get a very clear, and she keeps an in. So you get a real connection with, you know, there's more going on. There's the Christ story again. But, and humanity, I kind of looked at this and thought, it's kind of like the incarnation. This is how messy it is to be alive, you know, a lot of the time,
mm-hmm.
not to this extreme. But she had said that what struck her about the whole script was they didn't make the violence glamorous. And I think Quentin Tarantino does that, doesn't he?
Without question.
And I don't know. It played for laughs sometimes.
Yeah, without question, like in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and the playwright or the screenwriter and director had said that when he was thinking about putting the juxtaposition of gangsters in this gorgeous town, that he'd always wondered what happened to the stray bullets. You know, you show somebody spraying a place with bullets and only the people you care about are getting shot at. They either get hit or they don't. He goes, so that's what made him think of, you know, like with the little boy, with anything else. And when the actress who played Marie said, it shows that this isn't glamorous. It's horrible and repulsive to be violent like this. And I thought, oh, that's really what he does here. You know, Ray's getting shot. It's not, oh, I just take it and keep going. I mean, he's still staggering. But it's not, it looks like it hurts. It looks awful.
Yeah.
And it's in this movie. The reason I watched it, despite it being so violent, is there used to be a podcast. Well, I think it's still out there, but it was what, Theology at the Movies or something like that, Watching Theology. And this was on their movie Christmas list. They were picking things that deliberately weren't, of course, traditional Christmas movies, but this was like maybe number one in terms of making you think about what Christ gave when he was born into the world. Oh, no, sorry. Die Hard was number one because that was one of them's favorite movie, no matter what. So I was like, oh, and that's what made me watch Die Hard, which is now one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, but
I know. But that's what made me watch this, because I was so intrigued by the fact that in this movie I'd heard was so violent, there was a strong enough underlying moral theme that they would recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never heard that. They did talk about Pulp Fiction or one of his movies at some other point of being, you know, there's a moral strain thread in there. But I get the feeling when I watch this, because I'm looking, that it was carefully constructed. It doesn't slap you over the face with it if you're just watching it, but it's definitely there on purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you there.
And I know Americans are said to be addicted to violence. And it's very true. If I hear something's R-rated, I'll go, oh, it's not for explicit sex, it's just for violence. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so what do you think? Do you think Americans are addicted to violence?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Or desensitized? Well, I don't know. How can we be addicted to violence and nobody else is? Maybe in our entertainment is what people mean. Good heavens, there's violence all over the place. Maybe that's it. Most people wouldn't watch it for entertainment because they know what it is, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine people from Darfur watching something really violent just for the entertainment of the violence.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I watched James Bond not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Both of the new ones, Casino Royale and... what is it?
That's
quantum something.
Solace, which I haven't seen.
Quantum Solace, but yeah, they're very violent, you know, for James Bond. I mean, it's a kind of different. Mm-hmm. The chase scene at the beginning of Casino Royale is probably the best chase scene I've ever seen. It was exciting at the beginning of that first movie.
Remember it?
Oh yeah, it
Isn't
was cool.
Funny.
Yeah, But I'm just saying, you know, that's what it was. Is just a, you know, it was very violent.
And well, now I will say that Casino Royale is very true to the book.
Is it?
All the scenes that people complained about in Casino Royale when it came out, like him being tied to that chair and being beat with the cane.
Yeah.
I was like, I read the book when I was a teenager, which I probably shouldn't have been allowed to do, but I had free reign of everything at that point. And I remember being shocked when I read it in the book. And, you know, he's not a very great writer, so.
Mm-hmm.
But most of that stuff, not the bringing himself back from the heart attack thing or whatever, but the other stuff was real.
Hmm. Interesting, so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't read anything by Ian Fleming.
My opinion only. People may refute that. I don't feel like you're missing much. He was kind of heavy-handed. And
Yeah.
In fact, my mom was saying that the other day. She's like, I tried one of his books again, and they're awful. I went, yeah.
Yeah, but from Hollywood, though, you know, those kinds of movies, you know, they're definitely getting more violent. Mm-hmm. In order for it to be considered exciting or whatever.
Shock value.
Yeah, the shock value of it is, that line's been moved a lot in the past 20 years.
Hard to imagine it being moved a lot past this. Of course, now that I say that, it will have been. But,
yeah.
But in this, the violence all has a point.
Yeah, and I agree that here, the violence, them not shying away from that moment of impact, for example, was something that I think it was deliberate, and you know, it was shocking, you know, and I think that the fact that it was shocking and not kind of like a, you know, if the reaction was something different from shock, I think that it wouldn't have been right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's like, it's that thing of, these are the prices people really pay in real life when they sacrifice.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not throwing yourself off a building, really. But, you know, what did Christ go through?
Mm.
It was not nice.
Yeah.
In a way, this is like a passion play.
Yeah,
this
in
is
a way,
the cost
it sure
of being,
is.
Yeah, it's the cost of being a real, live human being and really giving of yourself to when it hurts. You can't always see it. And that's why this thing made me think of the point of a Hieronymus Bosch painting, because it makes it vividly alive in front of you. It's repulsive. You can't ignore it. But at the same time, it's beautiful because of what it really means.
Mm.
And that's the point of the incarnation. And that's the point of what Christ did for us. And that's why I thought you were so smart and brilliant to pick this for a Lenten movie.
Mm.
You know?
Why, thank you.
Well,
you're the one who told me to watch it in the first place.
That's why I push it on people. It's, you know, and I just hadn't noticed all the other really deliberate little hints and pointers until this third time through it.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting stuff.
It's shocking and repulsive to the point that when you said In Bruges, I'm like, oh, yeah, great movie. I don't want to watch it again. Because what you remember is that real vivid stuff. And then I was watching it going, oh my gosh, I forgot how great the acting is and how well this is put together and all the little points and the, you know, I remembered the funny stuff, but not all the details of it. And
well, I'll remember Colin Farrell's performance.
Oh.
You know, we've talked a lot about Brendan Gleeson, who was excellent. I mean, he really, really was. And Ralph Fiennes as Harry was, I mean, that was great, too.
It's fun to watch him doing such a crude character.
Yeah, but Colin Farrell was fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, from the very first moment where they get into the room at Bruges, you know, first of all, he finds out that they have to share a room for two effing weeks.
Yeah.
And then they're having a conversation, and Ray is basically asking, you know, well, why are we here? And there's a silent moment in between them, and then Ray just says, why do you have to bring that up? You know, from that moment on, he's that guilt is with him all the time, and it just manifests itself at all these moments in the movie, and man, did I feel for him.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a quiet moment.
Yeah. Another scene I remember really well that I thought he did so well was when he was at the restaurant with the girl he met, Chloe. And she says, "So what is it that you do?" And he says, "Well, I kill people for money." And she thinks he's joking. And then he asks her, and she says, "I sell drugs to film crews." And I think he thinks she's joking, but neither of them are joking. And then, you know, he realizes pretty quick that she's not joking. But he says, "Do I look like I kill people?" And she says, you know, jokingly, "No, but maybe just kids." And his reaction to, I mean, it was just amazing.
It was subtle because he was covering totally, up, very but it was subtle. Just a touch. And you just go, oh, that just stabbed him in the heart. And it's funny because it's he naturally, you can tell, fills his life with frenetic activity anyway from the fact that he hates Bruges so much.
Yeah.
And it's such a quiet place. But you get the feeling because of every quiet moment he has, he either is seeing children around him because it's a tourist town, or he'll be lying there in bed at night and suddenly his face changes and his eyes fill with tears because he can't shake that. He remembers what he did. And they have a pivotal conversation where Ken's trying to make him feel better. And he's like, "No, you can't. I didn't mean to do it." He goes, "Well, you didn't intend to do it." And intentions do count for a lot. He's like, "But, I mean, as a Catholic, intention is everything. If we do something bad and we didn't intend to do it, if we weren't doing something else bad, it's not really on us, so to speak." It's not as bad of a thing. He's like, "Yeah, but I can't deny that the choices I made because of my actions, that little boy is never going to be here again." And he was doing something awful. I mean, he was shooting the priest, who must not have been a very good person, or Harry Potter wouldn't have been saying hi that way. But but even so, he can't shake the fact that it was his fault. And a lot of people would be grasping at what Ken gave them. And he didn't.
And it isn't it interesting as well, you know, when I watched it the first time, I was bothered, but just until I realized something. They never explained why the priest was getting this hit in the first place. But I realized that it makes no difference.
Right.
Because Ray may not even have known why. It doesn't make any difference. That's his job. He's just going to do it. And that wasn't the story of the movie. So it became, you know, the right choice. Another moment of Ray's that wasn't even on film. When Ken comes back and the innkeeper's wife says, "Hey, he gave me this money." You know, Colin Farrell had done such a good job to that point that I could almost see that scene of him giving her that money and explaining to her, "Hey, you know, give this to your kid." And having asked her all these questions about her kid and, you know, and all that stuff and, you know, what sex it's going to be and all that. So, again, you know, when you talk about it being well constructed, the fact that the writer knew that he didn't have to show that scene was kind of a interesting choice and extremely well done. Because I could see that scene. You know, it wasn't in the movie. I can see
Though. No. Yeah. And you can see it because I was thinking about how well he turned this person into such a more of a childlike character. You know, he always kind of had a little frown on his face if he wasn't sure what was going on, like a little kid might, trying to figure something out, and he would chew his nails. Just all these little characteristics he invested that character with that all conveyed. He had a very childlike nature that way. "Oh, they're filming midgets. Brilliant." You know,
It's
like a circus.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah.
And, but you know, I was thinking about how well constructed it was, and I may have realized this before and just forgotten it, but right down to the point of when they're going to go up to that bell tower the first time, or, Ken is. And he's trying to pay in euros, and he's 10 cents short. And he's got all these coins, a huge handful of coins, and the guy won't accept anything less than the full amount. And so he takes all those coins back. Well, when he's up in the bell tower later to make sure that no one might get hit by him, and I'm like, I can't believe you were thinking of that at this moment. He takes that handful of coins and drops it out of the tower.
Mm-hmm.
And so these coins start hitting, and everybody just gets out of the way. And then he throws himself down. And I'm like, wow, that's a touch that nobody ever thinks of, but it's a very practical, what would you do? How would this work? Oh, well, now he's got a handful of coins. Oh, here's why he has it.
Wow.
You know, yeah. I mean, yeah, just all these little things. And that's what made me go, oh, those things when I was going, oh my gosh, that trail of blood, that's like going up that tower the first time. This is the bookend moment to it when the blood turns liquid in moments of great crisis or stress, he said.
Yeah, yeah, at the Basilica of the Holy Blood. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And that kind of thing. And that's, it was the thing with the coins where I went, okay, I'm not making this up. This is all deliberately worked in. So yeah,
for certain, for certain.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can't help but chuckle there because, okay, I'm going to go touch that vial because that's what you do. Do you want to come with me? Like, do I have to? No, you don't effing have to. It's only Jesus, the blood of Christ. Christ's
blood. You don't effing have to go to the effing tower, but it's like, oh, good.
Oh, it's man. Like, yeah.
What am I going to do with you?
Made me laugh.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, it's, boy. How funny.
Let's see.
So yeah, if, go see this movie. Yeah, well, again, I assume that you have if you're this far, but
yeah,
what a movie.
Oh man, yeah.
Really. Yeah, so it's nice to know that he's gonna have another one out. I would be interested to see his plays.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so yeah, you know, they don't do that too often now where they put a play on film. You know, it doesn't always work out, does it? I remember HBO a long time ago, when we originally first had HBO, they'd show, I remember seeing, oh, what's that Neil Simon play about the couple that, young couple that lives in New York, brand new.
Barefoot in the Park.
That's it, Barefoot in the Park. I remember seeing that on HBO way back when. And, you know, I liked it. I thought it went pretty well. But they don't do a lot of that, do they?
Yeah, no. Well,
and it's probably right because, you know, theater's not meant to be on the film. You were supposed to be there live.
Well, and there are some that work, like you say, Barefoot in the Park. I remember liking that too. And then I'll tell you one that really does work well is Dial M for Murder, which is Alfred Hitchcock took a play. And you can see it, but he shoots it from so many different angles that he's able to give you the illusion of, you know, he keeps it more interesting that way. And he does do like one or two shots outside the apartment, but that's it.
I see.
But usually, and maybe Rear Window.
Was Rear Window was a play?
I don't think that was a play. That was a short story.
Yeah, and I mean, movies from plays often work. I'm just talking about when you actually take the stage production and make a movie or just film it.
Oh, yes. So
Barefoot in the Park was the stage production, just filmed.
Yeah.
It starred the guy who played John Boy. I can't remember his name.
Okay, then I'm thinking of the movie because I'm thinking of Robert Redford and Jane Fonda, which is such a funny pairing now that I think of it.
I don't think I've seen that movie. I've just seen the play.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It actually was, I was so young, but I remember it being amusing. But I was thinking, I'll tell you one that doesn't work. Oh, gosh, what is it? We saw it here in Dallas, and then we saw it at the West End. And it's been made into a play with Carol Burnett. Noises Off. Never see it unless you see the play.
The play's good, huh?
Oh, my gosh. It's the most... It's basically, it shows a play three times through. From the front, where you see what's happening, and they're practicing for their opening. Then from the back, where you've seen the development between all the characters as they've been on the road for a long time, and then what's going on behind the scenes. And it's so funny. And then you see the last performance from the front after everything's deteriorated even more. And it turns into this slapstick farce that, because by then you know the play really well, you know everything that's gone wrong. And it's hilarious if you ever get a chance to see a local production.
Oh, cool. Maybe we'll have to look at doing that here.
Yeah, you have to be able to turn the set around somehow. Okay.
All right.
But I think that would be a great one. It would probably be a challenge, but I remember that the playwright or the director, maybe it was the same person who first did it, said he wrote it after being on the road on one of those plays for a long time and watching how awful it is slogging through all that stuff. as people, you know, have romances and break up and form alliances and then break those up. It sounds like a reality TV show or something, but it's just gut-bustingly funny.
Oh, cool. Yeah, definitely take a look at that.
Yeah. So, great. But it does not work in the movie at all.
Mm, gotcha. Gotcha. All right. So it says on here, Seven Psychopaths is 2012. He wrote it and wrote and directed. It's in post-production. Starring Colin Farrell.
Hey.
Woody Harrelson, Christopher Walken.
Wow.
Olga Kurylenko, Abby Cornish, Sam Rockwell.
Oh, my favorite.
Yeah. Gabori Sidibe. Someone like Kevin Corrigan, Tom Waits.
Oh,
well, lots of interesting folks.
I can sense the psychopath element there.
Seven psychopaths. Let's see. One, two, three, four. How many are in this? Yeah. So, yeah. Woody Harrelson, Colin Farrell, Christopher Walken, Sam Rockwell. That ought to be pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Sam Rockwell, my favorite everyman chameleon actor. He's so good.
Oh, cool. All right, yeah, it doesn't say here when in 2012, it just says 2012, so.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll have to, we'll keep everyone informed.
That's right.
If we ever find out.
You bet, you bet. Well, good. Yeah. So, yeah, so what do you think?
I think, I don't know, this is better than The Passion of the Christ. Watch this instead.
Oh, that reminds me. I found a book called Reflections on Passion of the Christ. Oh. I ran across it on Paperback Swap. So I said, oh, sure, send that to me, you know. And it's got a whole bunch of essays in it about Passion of the Christ, you know, from all kinds of points of view, you know, from the movie industry and, you know. All kinds of things, but... The one that made me laugh is the very last one is Steve Martin. it's him as a Hollywood type just sending a notes from the script back to Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, this person isn't Jewish enough. And I mean, it was just, you know, I can't do it justice by explaining, but you can just imagine. The notes that he made on the script, and it was funny. It was funny.
That does sound fun. Yeah. I've never heard of that book.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Yeah, just a collection of essays, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've read a few of them. You know, I don't know if I plan to read it all, but it's interesting how, you know, here we are all these years later from Passion of the Christ, and, you know, it was groundbreaking. In a couple of ways, but one of the ways is from the movie industry standpoint is that it was an independent film, and how incredibly well it did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of broke some barriers there.
Yeah, but it was never followed up on, really.
No, it sure hasn't been, yeah.
People kept going, this is going to change the kind of movie we see, and I was like, really?
Yeah, and no. This book was probably written from that, you know, too soon perspective where...
Yeah,
but there was some things from the movie industry. You know, there was a I remember an essay from a Jewish point of view, where you know there was a lot of concern about how
Jew bashing.
Yeah, how the movie was kind of a Jew bashing movie and that kind of thing. So, but interesting perspectives. But that's what the book is a collection of essays.
Yeah,
yeah. And speaking of Steve Martin, I read his tweet book. He wrote a book of tweets, and it's called the 10 make that 9 habits of effective people or something like that. Make that 10. Anyway, it was so funny. I was laughing out loud as I read it, and it's the book is. For charity, he's given the money. It's actually his own charity, which gives money to arts groups.
And, okay.
I heard an interview. Tam, our friend Tam, showed me this podcast called Triangulation, which is done by the Twit folks. And there's an interview of Steve Martin in a couple of episodes ago, and I'll link to it in the show notes of Triangulation. And it was an hour long interview with Steve Martin. It was kind of a side of Steve Martin that, you know, you don't really see. And Steve Martin is one of my favorite people on the planet.
Oh, I agree.
Everything he's done, I've enjoyed.
So,
you know, after that, and he said it was for charity. I was thinking, you know, tweets in a book, you know. But anyway, so I picked it up and I read it and I laughed. Yeah. So I've been on Twitter for a little bit, but
I'm going to have to get that for Tom and tell him about that podcast when I see the link, because he loves Steve Martin also.
Oh, that's good.
I mean, I like him a lot, but Tom really loves him. And he read his autobiographical book about.
Oh, I did too. Yeah. Life Standing Up or something like that.
That's it. And he told me key points, so I didn't have to read it.
And
which
that was interesting for me too, because his albums, I practically memorized them when I was younger. I played them so much. I know every word, you know, rambling around. He's a rambling guy. But, Born Standing Up is what it's called. And to listen to that now, having all this perspective, it was really interesting to hear, you know, some of the stand-up that he used to do. He used to take audiences outside. You know, in that book, it said that. And wow.
Tom told me about that part of the book.
Yeah. Come on, audience, let's go outside.
Yeah. He's like, well, I was stuck, so here's what I did. But he made it work, you know, always improvising.
Just fascinating. Yeah. Seems like an excellent guy.
Yep. He does seem like a good guy, good, solid, head screwed on straight kind of guy.
Yeah, you bet.
So, do you have, what are you doing for Lent?
Well,
If I may ask. That's not too forward of me to ask.
I gave up two things, but it's ended up being mostly in both cases.
Okay.
You know, when I asked myself, what are things that I'm doing that are taking too much time and are getting in the way, things that I'm doing instead of praying and things, both of them had to do with the internet. Politics had taken over too large a portion of my life. I was following this presidential election daily, reading stuff, watching stuff, getting angry, you know, getting happy, you know, letting that thing affect my mood. So that had to go. And then the other thing was soccer. And we've talked about this before, you know, sports in general. To me, you know, I can't explain how it happens, but when you get attached to a team, it can be kind of overpowering.
And, yes.
when a team loses a game, you know, you get upset. And when a team wins a game, you get happy. And, you know, again, I mean, it's interesting that I mentioned that in both cases. They were affecting my mood. And that's the bottom line, you know. So,
and it's nothing you can do anything about.
It's nothing you can do anything about. Yeah, it's like an outside force that you let in that's not God, that you're letting manipulate your feelings and, you know, with your consent. So that's the way that I felt about both those things. You know, I was at Mass listening to a homily by my priest, and that was what immediately came to mind when he was saying, you know, look at your life. What can you get rid of? Because, you know, it just leapt to mind. So that's what I did. But at the same time, it hasn't been able to be 100% in either case, because, you know, with sports, especially, you know, when I work where I work, that's what guys talk about.
Oh, right.
So, you know, I'm not there on the internet reading about it, but it's always coming up, you know. So I'm not keeping up, but I am talking about it.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, with the politics, I participated in a caucus last night, and which was a really, you know, I really wanted to participate because it's the first time Idaho's ever had a caucus, and I was just really interested to see how that worked. You know, for you guys in states that have caucuses all the time, you know, this is brand new for us. This was our very first one. So anyway, it was an interesting experience. You know, kind of feel like a bit of history. You know, here in Idaho, we don't matter that much when it comes to politics. Usually, when anything gets it's okay.
Yeah.
When anything gets our way, it is over. Yeah, it is over. So it's been interesting. They moved the caucus to Super Tuesday. Well, they created a caucus, then put it on Super Tuesday.
Right.
And presidential candidates actually came to Idaho, which is the first time in my memory that any campaigning has been done in Idaho ever. I didn't get to go to any events, but Santorum and Romney and Ron Paul and Gingrich all showed up to Idaho.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's... Well, and see, my involvement with politics is fairly limited. I mean, I read the Wall Street Journal, so that means I'm always kind of seeing it. But, you know, we turned the TV on last night, and I went, they were talking about something political, and I went, oh, was today Super Tuesday? You know, so.
Yeah. I tell you what, before Lent, I was, you know, watching Morning Joe in the morning, and I was at lunch at work. That's what I would read. And when I got home, I'd pop on some stuff. And, you know, I swear, if I added up all the time, it was significant. And to allow it to affect my mood is when you know that it's too far. You know, not that politics shouldn't affect your mood. You should care, and you should try to do something, you know.
Right.
But I'm doing enough right now. I've got a lot going on. I'm participating, yeah. So yeah. I feel like that had to go. That had to go.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And for me, politics tends to become more issue oriented, like the HHS mandate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Catholic Church's.
Yeah, and you can't ignore that
against
stuff.
It is something that I can't ignore. Right. But the thing I was just kind of reflecting on this while you were talking, thinking, well. It will kind of get me angry sometimes, and sometimes it will make me despair a little bit. But the interesting effect overall, now that I think about it, is it has really made me turn to prayer much more. Because what I've realized is, because of my Happy Catholic blog, I can publicize, you know, pieces of information that people might not see otherwise. But other than that, and, you know, my particular vote in an election, I have no power. I mean, you know, I can send letters. I have no power.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it's made me do is really kind of thrown me back on having to trust our leaders and having to pray for our leaders. And I'm talking about not just the government, but the Catholic bishops and anybody else who's a leader who has any effect in this, and having to trust that God will help these people do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, that he will support us through whatever the consequences are of not having done the right thing. I mean, it's really been one of those situations, I guess, that some people go through when, well, my house is burned down. Here I am, you know, just me and God. But in this case, it's done that for me. And so in that case, it's been actually kind of beneficial, I suppose.
Mm, that's good. Yeah, maybe that's what I need to be looking at. That's an interesting way.
Yeah, I just...
Yeah, so thanks for that. I will do that.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. I just, like I say, it was a realization where I was like, I fervently pray, but then I have to leave it in those hands because it's not my deal.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I gave up something I really was not on my radar at all, which was I was sitting in the back of our RCIA room while the big presentation on Lent's going on to everybody, and I'm kind of sitting there listening to it going, I already know what I'm giving up. This is not going to be that big of a deal. This is going to be fine. I need to give it up, which was listening to the iPod in my earbuds at work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, you know, really, I should be concentrating just on my work, and I can listen to music through the speakers or something. And
sure.
I'm like, okay, that won't be a big deal. And I'm not kidding. It was like into my mind, almost as if it were in front of my eyes, floated this image, like a neon sign of two cocktail glasses. And I went, in my mind, I went, no, oh, crap. If that's my reaction, that means I need to get And I told Tom, and he said, well, but we just have cocktails twice a week, and one of those is on Sunday when you're allowed to have a little nibble of whatever it is, you know, as a celebration of Sunday. And I said, well, I'll give up all alcohol, you know, my wine with dinner, my beer with dinner during the week. And I'm like, but I really don't care about those that much. But I'm like, I feel like if I reacted that strongly, just giving it up at all is, you know,
yeah,
I'm much more attached than I knew.
How about that? Yeah.
It was hilarious, actually, later. And I got then going, I think I could get away from it. No, I got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And then I added on trying to memorize some scripture every week.
Yeah. Yeah, and you mentioned that to me. That's an excellent idea.
Discovered I'm crap at memorizing anything anymore. So this is probably good for me. I've managed after 2 weeks and great effort to memorize four lines of a psalm. But I was walking to work the other day, and it actually, the first two lines popped into my head as I was looking at the beautiful sky. And, you know, it's the heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. And I was like, oh, nice. Hey. So I then worked on solidifying the rest of it. But
excellent.
So now I've got to pick something new and go on to that.
Sounds good. Anyway. Well, good. So. All right. Well, I hope everyone else's Lent is going well.
Yeah.
And it has been fruitful for me.
Yeah.
Yep. So.
Yeah. Yep. And that's good.
That's what it's about, isn't it?
You got to scrape off those barnacles and refocus.
Yeah. And it's, you know, Lent is just great. Oh, and I am reading your book, by the way, again. Yeah.
Oh.
So, yeah, that's a daily thing for me.
Really? Yeah. And how is that working? I mean,
yeah, no, I love it.
I was curious because I had to sit down and write it, but okay, good.
Just yesterday, I don't know if I can call it up here. Let's see if I can't recall if I've got it loaded in my computer here or not, and I don't have my Kindle with me, but that's how I'm reading it.
Okay.
But yeah, shoot, I'd have to load it in. I don't have it here in front of me.
No, that's fine.
But it's cool. Isn't it cool to have Julie Davis right next to Steve Martin's book?
Okay, for me, that's... I'm going to go tell my husband. Guess what, honey?
Let's see what I have here. Steve Martin, Homer, Suzanne Collins, Seaman Seabag Montefiore, and Julie Davis. And Ted Chiang. How funny.
That's very surreal. That's a Hieronymus Bosch moment.
I love it. Yeah. But no, yesterday's was, that could have been read. I could have read that thing at this podcast because it was talking about sin and things. But no, I do appreciate it very much. I really do think it's a good thing for me.
So thank you for saying that because, you go through it and you do the very best you can. And then you look at it later and go, I worked that hard on this, because you don't have a proper perspective of any of it. You're too close to it.
Without question. I know what that feels like.
It's helpful.
Yep. It sure is. And,
How are you enjoying the other thing I'm making you read?
So far I'm enjoying it. I am.
Jane Eyre.
Jane Eyre. Yes. Yeah. Okay. We have to link to the, to that Goodreads post.
How is Jane Eyre linked to Captain Kirk and Green Women? You'll never guess.
But at least, I know that I'm a very sensitive guy now.
Yeah, you are.
I love it. So I'm more Picard than Kirk, I guess.
Oh, he was much the better one. So.
Heck yeah. So that's our next book.
That's our next book.
Fantastic. Yeah. Yep.
And then I picked the next movie because it occurred to me that we haven't watched any classic old movies.
Ooh, okay.
So, and I thought of several, but after In Bruges, I was like, let's go for something a little lighter. So this is To Be or Not to Be from 1934.
All right.
Okay. Pretty sure it's 1934.
And I have not seen
1943.
That one. 1943.
Okay.
Yeah.
I knew there was a 3 and a 4 in there somewhere.
I watched Casablanca recently, which was 1942, I believe.
Okay.
Or 41, maybe.
I thought of
maybe.
That movie also.
Okay.
But I thought, I really considered it. But To Be or Not to Be, I hadn't seen it, but I'd always heard it's really
this is,
great movies you really should watch.
Carol Lombard and Jack Benny?
Jack Benny.
Okay.
And... yeah, and you would never believe what great actors these both are. And it's set during World War II. They're Polish actors in a theater, and the Germans invade.
Ah,
it's a perfect setup for a comedy, right?
Yeah.
No. And it's funny because it's definitely a comedy. It's really well done. And, of course, it's got a more serious vein underneath. So.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds cool. I'm looking forward to it.
Good.
All right. Okay. Well, yeah. All right. That should do it for this week, shouldn't it?
Gosh, I guess so.
Well, have a good couple of weeks, everybody. We'll see you back here with Jane Eyre.
Yes, Jane weeks. Eyre. A lot of drama and sensibility.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. See you in a couple of weeks, everyone. Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.